coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Dover Mall is the latest mall to face significant changes as shopping habits change.
They have vacancies, and like other malls, some of their tenants, their newer tenants, are non-traditional.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida examines how Dover Mall is remaking itself. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our latest arts playlist previews the production of Little Women coming to the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington. And we have the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Shopping malls across the country are remaking themselves as the retail landscape that once led to their growth and popularity continues to shift in ways that leave many of them struggling now. The latest mall locally to see some major changes is Dover Mall. Like the Concord Mall in North Wilmington that we've previously reported on, the Dover Mall is trying to find ways to reclaim foot traffic. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida has followed the evolution of malls in the First State for us, and this week takes a closer look at Dover Mall in her latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And Eileen joined me this week to discuss what she learned. Joined on The Green this week by contributor Eileen Dalabrida, who takes a look at Dover Mall and how it is going through changes as it, like so many malls across the country, try to figure out their place in the retail landscape. Eileen, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us this week about your story.
Good to be here, Tom.
So, Eileen, let's start with a thumbnail sketch of what Dover Mall was like at its height. What did it offer, and how did it compare with other malls when it was one of the places to go for shopping?
Well, in its heyday, Dover Mall had seven anchors, and that included Sears and Macy's, JCPenney, Boscov's, Dick's Sporting Goods, and Old Navy. And, you know, it was a happening place, the third largest mall in Delaware. And when it opened back in the 1980s, it almost immediately knocked Blue Hen Mall out of the box.
So what have the past 10 years been like for Dover Mall as it and these other malls, as we mentioned, have dealt with this shifting retail landscape?
Yeah, it's been a tough 10 years for retail, and especially for malls. So the biggie was that Sears closed in 2018, and that impacted many, many malls. And then another big blow when Macy's stopped its in-store sales and transitioned that huge department store into a fulfillment center. Nationwide, it was during that time, 9,300 retailers went out of business. So a lot of spaces and malls went dark, and it was a very tough time.
I was going to say, I mean, for a mall like Dover Mall, I imagine it's somewhat, I guess, a good sign that it stayed in business and it's managed to kind of last this long.
Oh, yeah. And it's owned by Simon, which is the nation's largest mall operator. So they're truly plugged into the retail scene. I mean, these folks do know everybody, and that's a big plus for them.
So now Dover Mall, like other malls, as we've mentioned, are trying to make changes, specifically malls at Dover's size. One big change, as you mentioned, was the anchor stores closing, and in this case, the former Sears store. So tell us a little bit more about what happened with Sears closing there and how the Sears closure at Dover Mall maybe played out differently than Sears closures elsewhere around the country.
Well, Dover is one of the minority of Sears stores that is going to remain a retail space. I mean, you know, if it closed in 2018, it's been dark for quite some time. Well, the lights are going on. It's My Style Home Furnishings, and that's operated by Furniture and More, is going to be opening either at the end of April or early in May. And Furniture and More is the largest furniture retailer at the Delaware beaches. It has seven locations. in Delaware and Maryland, and they are completely revamping that anchor and getting ready to roll.
So the other big thing that happened recently with Dover Mall is it lost its long-running movie theater there. Tell us a little bit about what happened there and what's the impact of losing that movie theater.
Well, for the first time in 40 years, Dover Mall doesn't have a theater. And actually, Dover in general no longer has a theater. AMC, which operated it, said that they do regular performance reviews and that they decided that the numbers just weren't there. So they bang, gone.
We talked a little bit about the change in the former Sears anchor store. What other things are going on at Dover Mall in terms of its restructuring its lineup? What do we know about the direction that Dover Mall is trying to head in?
Well, they have vacancies, and like other malls, some of their tenants, their newer tenants, are non-traditional. They have an office there for Walmart's truck driving school. They also have been bringing in a few new restaurants to the food court, and they're just filling in as they can.
How about Concord Mall? Does Dover Mall perhaps learn anything from what Concord Mall is doing?
Well, I think that the Concord Mall has a bigger challenge, but it's also related to Sears because their Sears store is still empty, and it's so much bigger than the one was at Dover. The Sears store at Concord is two stories. It's 180,000 square feet, and they have floated such ideas as a community theater, and it just hasn't flown. So what we're seeing going on at Concord Mall is as well the non-traditional uses. It's they brought in a caterer, and they also picked up a lot of independent retailers from when the Tri-State Mall closed, a big nail salon, things like that. And that's been their strategy.
So we've talked about this idea of smaller independent retailers and service providers kind of taking over vacancies at malls, using those smaller spaces that used to be kind of like the usual suspects of like clothing and record stores and what have you. And you talk specifically to one of these type of smaller, non-traditional providers at Dover Mall. Can you tell us a little bit about them and how they've taken this opportunity to maybe create a business that might not have been able to be created if it was a standalone operation?
Slime Zone and More. It's run by two women who have a background in early childhood education, and they're entrepreneurs, and they focus on science activities and experiments for kids. And although they do have some adult customers, and they opened up in a spot that was previously occupied by a tuxedo shop. So you see, a business whose time has clearly passed, not a lot of call for formal wear these days. And they opened up. They got a good deal on rent. They're very happy about that. And they wanted to appeal to parents shopping with kids who were looking for something different for their kids to do while they were at the mall. And so they report that their business has exceeded their expectations, and they're doing quite well and are very happy at Dover Mall.
So we've talked about these malls like Dover and Concord Mall being, I guess what you've called in your reporting, B-level malls. And you noted in your story that the value of these B-level malls has fallen, but overall sales and occupancy numbers are showing an uptick. Is there a sense maybe that these B-level malls might be finding their role and audience by, as I guess we've kind of talked about here, not trying to reclaim their past glory or compete with the Christiana malls and such of the world?
Yeah, they are continuing to evolve, and many of them are not going to be traditional malls because housing is increasingly part of the equation, especially in urban areas. So you're seeing malls just give up on trying to find a tenant for Sears or J.C. Penney or the old Macy's or whoever has gone out, and they are just knocking it down and building what's selling, luxury rental apartments or even condos. Or for in one place in California, they put in a huge Asian grocery store. So I think that, when the light bulb went on and a mall operators fully embraced that they're going to have to do something different, and it could be radically different, things started to change. And that's been a healthy part of the evolution of the mall.
So, Eileen, you've been looking at malls for us for a couple of years now. Where do you see things headed? Do both A and B level malls that remain have paths forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that even the moribund malls will go on to a new life. We've seen a number of malls go the route of Blue Hen, in that real estate is going for another purpose, such as government offices or medical space. There was one mall in Colorado that had a huge dark space that they turned into a shooting range. I mean, that they're it's just like, what can we do with this space? But that said, even the A malls are going to face challengers as retailers are taking a really hard look at where they want to be. And some of the national chains like Foot Locker and Bath and Body Works have decided that malls isn't really where they want to be anymore. So they're going into lifestyle centers and other kind of smaller, more destination. Individual destination shopping centers. So I think that no matter how successful a mall is in years to come, we're going to see tweaks and new strategies. And as retail evolves, and we say, like, what do to get people to come in and shop with us?
It is certainly a fascinating thing to watch and chart, and we appreciate you doing that for us, and hopefully you will continue to do so. Eileen Delabrate, as always, we appreciate your time and we appreciate your reporting. Thanks so much for being with us on The Green.
Always good spending time with you, Tom.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Delabrate for her time on The Green this week. Her piece on the Dover Mall is available at DelawareRepublic.org. And stay with us. Art's Playlist is next, with a preview of Little Women, the musical, coming to the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington next month. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. In 1868, Louisa May Alcott published Little Women, the story of four sisters in Massachusetts growing up, falling in love, and coming into their own. More than 150 years later, the story has seen dozens of adaptations, and this May you'll have the chance to see it come alive on stage with Little Women the Musical at the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington. In this edition of Art's Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel sits down with cast members Cameron Hamm and Noah Harris, as well as conductor Thomas Fasnacht, to learn more about their roles and the Little Women tour.
Let's start with Cameron. You were born and raised in Southern California. This is your first national tour, I believe, correct?
Yes, that's right. It's my first national tour. It's the first national tour of a lot of people in our company, too. So it's very exciting getting out across the country and seeing different parts. I myself have only been to a handful of states. So this, you really get to see a lot of different places at one time. And it's been such an incredible experience.
All right. You just said a lot of different places at one time. Is that overwhelming at all?
I guess I think I thought it was going to be more overwhelming than it was. I think it's a lot easier to stay grounded when you have such an incredible cast. We have a great group of people. The band is great. The cast is great. The crew is great. And everybody's really there to support each other. And that makes it a lot easier. So if one person's feeling a little tired, a little down one day, the other people can really, you can lean on them.
Is that kind of what you expected?
Yeah, I think I was going in prepared to, you know, hopefully get close. It's such a family show, so we really hope to build chemistry there. But I wasn't prepared for how close I would get to these people. Like, usually, you know, you go in and you can kind of expect, okay, maybe I might not jive with every single person, but everyone on this tour is so nice and kind and really down to earth and so talented at the same time. Like, I'm just always in awe of them and who they are, how they carry themselves on stage and off. So it's been a real pleasure. And I think, you know, a happy, happy surprise. So
you've done a lot of television, some films. So you've been in that two-dimensional world pretty solidly. But you're also in this live world. Is it the same? Is it different?
It definitely has some differences. I feel like film and TV is very fast-paced. A lot of times you'll focus one day on a handful of scenes, and then the next day you move on. And this, of course, is live theater, and we're doing a full 3-hour production every single day. So you really have to focus on, you know, your habits, keeping your voice healthy, making sure that everything is sustainable. And also, it's so interesting, Noah and I were just talking yesterday about how the show evolves day to day, depending on our audience, depending on where we go, our environment, depending on how we're personally feeling. And it's such a beautiful thing to be able to experiment and make different choices. And from the time we started in January to now, the show has really evolved. And I think that's a beautiful thing about live theater that's unique to live theater.
You play Beth March in Little Women. Can you tell us a little bit about that role and what you're going to bring to the overall story there?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's been such a pleasure to be able to play this character and uncover her layers. She is the third oldest of four sisters. I myself have three sisters, so it's really a story that's close to home for me. But she's quiet and reserved on the surface, but she really has a calm strength about her. She's the source of strength for her sisters, I think. She is defiant in her own way. She sees the kindness in the world that's not always kind, and she sees the good in her sisters and really helps them to believe that they can believe in themselves. And she sees their strength and where they can achieve, where they don't always feel that they can. So she's important to the story in that way. And it's been a real pleasure to, yeah, peel back those layers.
Cameron, thanks so much for your answers there. Let's turn to
Noah.
Thank you so much. Hey, sure. How's it been going for you? What stands out most about the experience so far?
It's been great. It's also just been an experience I never thought I would have at this stage in my life. I was in school when I auditioned, and I, you know, kind of was locked into being in school for the 4 years and committed to not really auditioning for anything and not looking for work actively. But I just heard about this audition and thought I might as well try. And it's, I mean, I'm almost seeing it as like a studying abroad type of thing, because in school, I'm already studying musical theater and getting my BFA in that. So it's really kind of just like a different format of studying musical theater, very hands-on version of what I'm doing in school anyway, which has been just such a cool and unique experience for me, for sure. And just learning from being actually out on stage and in the throes of it, I guess, has been already just such a great learning experience. And I've learned so much just about being a musical theater artist from that.
You the idea that you you're kind of on a dual path here, because you are going to college, and that's a full-time job in a lot of ways. But you've got a little bit of a career. You got some chops in the business already. You've got some commercials, the computer school pilot on HBO Max. How does all that kind of feed into what you're doing now, the television, the camera experience? Similar to what we asked Cameron, but has it helped? Because, you have this fortune of kind of at the same time that you're learning about it, you're learning about it.
It's interesting. I've done some on-camera work and some film stuff that's on my resume, but I haven't had as extensive experience in it as I have in live theater, even though I don't have so many live theater credits on professional live theater credits on my resume. It's what I've been doing my whole life, and musical theater has always been my primary passion. So I think on camera work has always been the more foreign thing to me. It's very fun, and it was also such like a adjustment to like be on set for a day and get paid so much, which is definitely a known difference. I mean, working as an actor, which is great, but I for me, nothing compares to live theater. Yeah, that's special to me.
Tom, you you have a presence here in this region and a name and a following. So a little bit more about the experience of how you ended up here. What's the choice?
I had never done a tour like this. And this was my first time getting to do this, getting to be in every stage of the development of this, sitting in the casting room, watching these two talented actors come together, and just seeing the chemistry with them right away was really special. So getting to start there, getting to be in the rehearsal room with them for about 3 weeks, then landing in Kentucky, meeting my pit musicians, getting to hire them as well, putting that together, putting every single piece of this puzzle together, it was a fabulous experience. And doing this tour, seeing the whole country, was something that really appealed to me as well.
You mentioned being in a little bit on the creative side for this specific production, and it gives you kind of an inside ear to what happens with this score and why the music works. Any observations that you feel like anybody just reading the story would say, well, what do you need music for? It's a beautiful story.
Oh, no. Even if you know the show very well, even if you've read the book a million times, if you've never heard of Little Women before, the music will bring you in and introduce you to a whole new facet of the March family that you might not know from just reading the book, seeing the fabulous movie that just came out a few years ago. The music is really a core component. That is another thing that really drew me to this show is how much we get to play and just really play as musicians. A lot of Broadway shows, it's a lot of putting on a metronome, playing a couple chords, everything kind of lines up. This isn't that kind of show. This is a show where you're going to feel what we're feeling, the musicians. You're going to feel what the singers are feeling and, you know, pushing and pulling the tempos, feeling those swells of emotion. You'll see that on the stage and you will feel that in the pit as well. There aren't a lot of shows that I've done that have quite that degree of sensitivity and emotion to them.
Most of the performance, your back is to the audience. When you turn for that that acknowledgement to the audience, are you surprised? We just went through, and we're still going through it in many ways, and you're very aware of it with the Delaware scene and what's going on here and recovery, not just from COVID, but from the after effects of being stagnant for a while. Do you, as you work your way across the country, are you seeing healthy audiences? Do they want us live anymore?
I have been pleasantly surprised. We have been having fabulous audiences, responsive audiences, people that are new to theater, some people that maybe are more movie people that are trying out theater for the first time. I would encourage anyone that has never seen a live show to give this one a try.
Thanks to Little Women the musical conductor Thomas Fasnacht and cast members Cameron Hamm and Noah Harris for joining our Carl Lengel on Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with the latest episode from the Delaware Humanities podcast series, A More Just Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week we bring you another episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. The podcast examines pivotal moments in legislation related to hate, prejudice, and the fight for equal rights in Delaware. In this second episode, we focus on the landmark Brown v. Board of Education U.S. Supreme Court decision that ended racial segregation in public schools. We'll discuss the two Delaware cases involved in Brown and look at how using the courts to advance the cause of integrating schools and delivering equity in education continues. The podcast features historian, writer, and Black history educator Kathy Trustee. She is owner of Black History Ed Zone, a company that produces Black history products to facilitate the inclusion of Black history in the classroom, and she is the author of multiple Black history children's books. Here is the latest episode of the A More Just Delaware podcast. So let's start specifically with Brown versus Board of Education. I think in recent years, we have seen more discussion locally of the two Delaware cases that were part of Brown. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of those two cases and how they fit into the Brown decision and its legacy?
Okay, the first case was Belton v. Gephardt. There were 12 students who lived in Claymont, Delaware, and they had to travel down to the all-Black high school in Wilmington to attend classes. And it became a bit of a struggle. It took a long time. I read somewhere at that time it took maybe an hour one way. And if you were involved in extracurricular activities, then that just added more to your day problems getting home. So parents in Claymont, Delaware, parents of the 12 students, sued the Board of Education to have their kids attend that school. And they were denied admission. The other case, Bueller v. Gephardt, Shirley Bueller was a six-year-old little girl. She had to travel. She attended the colored school. It was 107C, the colored school in Hokesson. And every day, a school bus passed, carrying white kids would pass her, taking those kids to school. But little Shirley had no transportation. Her parents would have to stop whatever they were doing for that day, drive her to school, and then go later on and pick her up. At one point, the mother did stop the bus driver to see if he would just carry her daughter some of the way to her school. Apparently her school was closer to the white school than her home. So wherever he would drop her off, she would be able to walk on her own to her school. And the bus driver said he couldn't do that. It wasn't that he did not. My understanding is not that he didn't want to do that, but he didn't have the authority to say, I'll take your child. And he actually suggested that she write a letter asking for transportation. And there's a letter that her parents wrote to the governor, I believe it was Governor Carvel at the time, asking for transportation. And they decided that they could not, they did not provide transportation for Black, or as they were called, colored at that time. So Shirley's parents decided to approach Lewis Redden, who was the first and only Black attorney in Delaware at that time. And the parents approached him because they simply wanted a bus to take their daughter to her own school. But Redden wasn't interested in that. He said he did not want to help them get their child to a segregated school. So he said, if you want to sue so your child could attend the white school, he would do that. And they agreed. And he was already representing the students in the Belton lawsuit. So he combined the two cases, and that's how they became Belton Bueller v. Gephardt.
I was going to say, so really Lewis Redden recognized the possibility of these two cases, particularly combined, having a real impact and being something that could set the standard for attacking the segregation of public schools in the nation.
Absolutely, yes. And he worked with, he was with the team of, just some background, there was a team of NAACP attorneys, brilliant attorneys, who were working on different cases. So Jack Greenberg, who was with the NAACP at the time, he and Lewis Redden filed the Belton Bueller cases in Chancery Court in here in Delaware. And the judge was Judge Colin Seitz. And he ruled in favor of the plaintiff. He actually visited the school that the high school students in Claymont were attending. He determined that it was inferior. I'm not sure if he visited the other school, but he did rule in favor of both of them. And he said that those 12 students should be allowed to attend Claymont High, and that little Shirley Bueller should be able to attend the white school and be on the bus in her neighborhood. But the problem with his ruling, even though he ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, it was not statewide. It only applied to those two cases. And the biggest problem with the attorney is that it did not in separate but equal. Colin Seitz felt that that was a decision of that was up to the Supreme Court. And because both sides appealed the case, the Attorney General appealed because they lost, and Redden and Greenberg appealed because they really wanted to strike down separate but equal in Delaware. And that's how they all, and as you know, all those cases went to the Supreme Court and they were combined there under Brown v. Board of Education.
So, of course, those cases wound up being essentially settled as part of the overall Brown decision. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact the Brown decision had in Delaware because of these two Gebhardt cases? And was the fact that Delaware had these specific cases involved, does that make kind of the impact or implementation of Brown a little bit different here than maybe elsewhere in the country?
To be honest with you, in all my research, the main impact of Brown was it established a legal principle. It ended separate but equal. But the Brown decision did not come with any type of enforcement. So the enforcement was really at the local level. And also, since Colin Seitz had already ruled in favor of, in 1952, of the Buehler and Belton, they both applied. I mean, those plaintiffs applied to those schools in September of 52, and they were accepted. Belton, the named plaintiff of the 12 students, she actually ended up staying at Howard High because by that time her family had moved. Nothing else really happened. Shirley Buehler went to the all-white school in Hillcrest, and she was well accepted. She stayed there for about 3 years. And it took some time for other students to eventually apply and begin attending these schools. So as I said, most of what happened after the Brown ruling was a result of local actions rather than the Brown case itself.
And because of that, I mean, there obviously progress still remains in many cases somewhat slow in yes. really truly desegregating schools both here and elsewhere. And I guess that wound up being the reason why there was further efforts to use the courts to move things along using the Brown precedent, but having to almost kind of piecemeal, case by case, move things forward.
Absolutely. And also, when the judges decided, the Supreme Court justices decided the Brown case, they did wonder, like, how was this going to be implemented? But Thurgood Marshall said, no, he was worried about the legal principle. He would take care of it at the local level. And that's how other cases would come up. But they had the legal principle. The precedent had been set. So that was how they were able to win the cases at the local level. And as you know, probably know, a year later, there was a second Brown decision because things weren't moving along. And in May of 1955, there was a second ruling, and the judges ruled that schools need to start desegregating and at all deliberate speed. But no one knew what that meant. And Thurgood Marshall, I don't know if he was joking or what, he said, that really just means slow. So there was no enforcement behind anything, but everything really took place at the local level.
And looking at that happening at the local level, we certainly saw that play out in Delaware in terms of busing. And we saw that obviously take place a lot of places, but certainly Delaware had its own history with busing to desegregate schools in 1978. Newcastle County was ordered to use busing to integrate schools, sending city students to suburban schools, suburban students to city schools to achieve racial integration. Obviously, that was a fraught process. It saw pushback from parents whose kids were in the city going to the suburbs and vice versa. But I guess the point I want to get to is, I guess, ultimately, as we saw busing play out, studies showed it seemed to have the desired effect on the numbers. It created racial balance numerically. But many wound up arguing that it didn't do so in terms of actual equity, in terms of discipline, the actual education students got. And I guess I want to ask this question, is the busing writ large kind of an example of the limitation that courts can have in advancing equity in education, that they can get the numbers right, but maybe they're not getting the actual equity right?
I agree with that. They can get the numbers right. But it wasn't just busing. Because of busing, for 10 years, maybe 12 years, Delaware had one of the most desegregated school districts in the country. Kentucky was the other state. And that was just, like you said, a numbers game. It was mainly because of busing. And but they didn't take in almost all decisions that and all laws that were passed. I think the intent was good, but I don't think they ever looked at the family dynamic just to see how things would affect the kids and the parents of these kids. So yes, you were absolutely right. It was more like a numbers game, but not much else.
Because it strikes me when we talked about the case involving the Belton case involving the kids in Claymont, part of the argument even you were mentioning was the fact that these kids had to go into the city if they were in, if they're in extracurricular activities or parents wanted to be involved in something in the school, that would, you know, the distance made a difference. And in some ways, busing did the same thing. You took kids from the city and put them out in the suburbs and made everything harder for their families. There is kind of a weird irony to that, right?
I know. I totally agree. And with busing, it was weird. And I still don't understand this. I think when they did start busing, it was the kids would go to the, well, I'm just going to call them white and black schools for 9 years, and then the other school for 3 years. I cannot get a good read on that. And I'm not sure what they were trying to accomplish with that, except to say we're complying with the Brown v. Board of Education decision. But other than that, that still has me a little bit baffled.
Yeah, it certainly was a process. And it's the process that, you know, we even hear discussion today about. I mean, even in his last presidential campaign, you know, current President Joe Biden, you know, Kamala Harris in a debate stage, bring up that issue where Joe Biden's trying to explain, you know, his position on busing, and even those explanations tend to be like, well, I'm for this, but I'm against the way it's happening. And I guess in a lot of ways, that's the problem with these court-ordered solutions, is that there is it really is, as even you were saying, hard to kind of get your head around exactly what's happening and the impact.
No, absolutely. And not just the court decisions, other laws that were passed. It's like the intent is always good. But as I said, I don't think they look at the full picture, the family, the income of the family, the family dynamic, whether or not the family had cars, like you said, to get back and forth to activities, extracurricular activities. They didn't look at any of that. I like I said, I do think the intent was good, but I don't know that enough effort was put into how is this all going to play out. Well, to the benefit of the kids.
So ultimately, the busing order was lifted here in Delaware in the mid-1990s. And shortly after that, speaking of laws by lawmakers, state lawmakers passed a series of laws, Charter School Act in 95, School Choice Act in 1996, Neighborhood Schools Act in 2000. And many have argued that these laws have essentially led to kind of a resegregation of schools, arguing that while the Neighborhood Schools Act mandated that barring exceptional circumstances, districts assign schools to the public schools closest to their homes, that's to address the issues we're talking about in terms of having family involvement and making life easier on families. While that was true of that law, the charter and choice laws often allowed students assigned to majority black schools in Wilmington to enroll in mostly white schools in the suburbs. Is that something that you think about as well, that there is kind of been almost a pendulum shift back to a resegregation because of these laws like charter school laws and school choice laws?
Absolutely. I always say that the Brown's legacy has not been fulfilled because of those laws. The ruling schools should desegregate. But because of other things that took place, I always say the schools are integrated, but they are not desegregated, meaning that segregation is illegal. So they're not intentionally segregating students, but the laws are actually unintentionally segregating, making segregation possible in the schools now. So, I look at that a lot and I think about that a lot.
And I guess the issue with this is that because it's kind of a different style of segregation, it may be harder to have a court rule to untangle this problem. Where Brown, it was very you should say it was very easy, but Brown was very clear. There was a precedent of separate but equal. It overturned that. In these cases, it's a lot more, I guess, subtle. And I guess that makes it a little bit more difficult for a court to untangle.
I totally agree. And I wonder if when Thurgood Marshall, when Supreme Court justices said that they did not know how they would implement, enforce the decision, I think maybe Thurgood Marshall thought maybe he did think at the local level they would be able to change a lot of things. But a lot of what happened with Brown happened also, I think not more was not done at the local level because I've heard someone call the Brown lawyers a dream team of lawyers. But what happened later on, so many of those lawyers, because of their brilliance, they all became judges. Thurgood Marshall became Solicitor General and then Supreme Court Justice. A bunch of them became lawyers. So that dream team of lawyers kind of disappeared. So I don't know if, and because the case was already settled, they'd won Brown, segregation was illegal. I don't know that other lawyers saw the need to, to pick that up again, to fight harder at the local level to make sure that things were implemented. So, I just don't know, what can be done about that even today.
Well, I guess the one thing we've seen locally in the courts is the recent case here in Delaware on education funding equity. The settlement of that case in 2020 has led to more state funding for education aimed at low-income children, English language learners, students in kindergarten through third that have special needs. It also led to property reassessments for the first time in decades that are actually happening now in an effort to get the funding right on education. And I guess most recently, as part of that lawsuit, there was a report on education funding in the state that called for more spending and changes to the funding formula. And I guess piggybacking what we're just talking about, is this kind of the next step is to find the other pieces of equity and go to the courts and try to solve that? In this case, looking at the funding piece of it, okay, we have integrated schools, but what we need is we need the funding to make sure the schools that need the most get what it needs.
Yeah, that needs to happen. But I don't think that's ever going to happen. For whatever reason, things tend to stop short. They know where the needs are, but I think the problem is putting things into place in action. Another thing that I often think about is HB 198, the Black History in Schools. That's a great idea. It should be taught, throughout the school year. But the problem is because it hadn't been taught in the past, who's qualified to teach it now and what should be taught? So, yeah, I mean, a lot of things are people are trying to do a lot of things to make all this work, but it tend to fall short. And it's funny that you mentioned the property value. I think early on, years ago, when they did the busing, I think Judge Schwartz actually talked about property value and what would happen with that. So that's not new. That started, they started talking about that years ago.
And it does feel like that's really, that there's two issues here. One is like there's the kind of what I generally call like the devil in the details piece of it. It's like, how do you actually make it work? And then the other is the will, right? The will for people to do the things that they've been asked to do, whether it be including Black history education in school curriculum or doing the things in terms of education funding that need to be done. Is that ultimately what it comes down to, is that the courts can say whatever they want to say, but if people don't have the will to do it, as you said, it's going to fall short?
Right, absolutely. A couple of days ago, I just happened to go online, with the school choice. There are schools where you can apply to go to any school, I guess, within your district or whatever. So when I looked online, there was a waiting list. So I was thinking about the parent. I sit at a computer all day, so I can always check a computer, see where see where I could get that child. If I'm looking at a parent who's working in a restaurant, they don't have access to that. So they miss out on a lot of things. So a lot of those laws, the intent was really good, but nothing is really done to help people navigate the system. The same thing with charter schools and all of that. There's a whole application process. Not enough is done to help parents get to where they need to get their kids to. The laws are there and they sound good. The intent is really good. I believe that the intent is good, but nothing is done to help parents get their students there, and which I believe is a real problem.
Are there some other areas that you feel are examples of equity issues that need to be addressed more and maybe a way that the courts can, or lawmakers can move it along in a better way? Or is it really we are at that point where it's a matter of will and people making the effort to do what the laws are asking them to do?
I think at this point it's a matter of wills. If you look at the laws on the books, there are some pretty good laws. I think it's a matter of getting more people involved, making people aware of what's out there and available to them, applying resources. Sometimes resources is more than money.
Mm-hmm.
Is sometimes, especially with the non-English language students and their parents. The students can, okay, but the parents, you need resources like that to get everyone involved. So, I really think there definitely needs to be more of an effort there.
Just a creativity maybe even in thinking outside of the box of how you can help people, as you said, access the tools that are out there.
Right. Absolutely. And a lot of people just don't have the tools all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or I look at it almost like voting. If you work in a restaurant, you can't get to the polls. It depends. Things are there, but you don't, it's not, if you can't navigate, if you don't know how to navigate that process, your child is always going to be left behind. And I think that's what's happening today.
So I want to wrap up our conversation by asking you this. We're now 60 years removed from Brown. How would you define its legacy at this point?
I'm sticking with it. Brown's legacy is unfulfilled. People have been fighting. People have been struggling with that for years. And like you said, all these new laws that were put into place. Schools are segregated again with the Neighborhood Schools Act. More white kids live in the suburbs, more black kids live in urban areas. So if you go into your urban school, if you go into your neighborhood school, your school students are going to look like you. So none of that, there's still a lot that needs to be done. And I just say the legacy of Brown is not fulfilled. I think things could have been done so that legacy is fulfilled. The greatest legacy was it was a catalyst in the civil rights movement. It did end that horrible doctrine of separate but equal, because separate was never equal. But other than that, and like I said, it set the legal principle. So there are tools, there is a precedent, there is a starting point to get things done. And I think that's the main legacy. It ended separate but equal, and it set a precedent. Lawyers can fight in lower courts to get things done.
Do you have optimism that legacy will ultimately be fulfilled?
No, I wish I did. I don't think so, but maybe because I wonder, because I go to schools now and I see they're definitely integrated, but I still say they're not segregated. I go to schools now and there's never a balance of 50% white, black, or whatever. It's not there. So I don't know if it will ever happen. If I just don't know. And I'm not really hopeful in my lifetime. It can change. It definitely can change. People are bright enough. They know what to do. They can do it. But attention spans are so for like five minutes. Now you're onto something new. So I'm not that hopeful.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware, with historian, writer, and Black history educator Kathy Trusty, discussing the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision Brown versus Board of Education, its links to Delaware, and the use of the courts to advance the cause of integrating schools and delivering equity in education. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. The podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Delaware Humanities is a recipient of United We Stand, connecting through culture funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support a more just Delaware and related programming. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.